You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for coming. And I'm supposed to thank our internet audience, too. We have our online, through the magic of internet, audience joining us as well. Today, we're going to be having a conversation about policing in America, race relations, community policing, and technological innovation. And this topic, you know, there's a lot to cover. I think most obviously there's been a lot of criticism of policing in America, particularly excessive violence towards civilians, shootings, most especially unarmed shootings of unarmed civilians, and the disproportionate effect that's had on the African-American community. And at the same time, there's been a real push to see if technology can be used to address some of these issues, right? Most famously, I think, body cameras, but, you know, lots of uses of data, both on the training side and then also on the analysis of policing. And, of course, important calls for policy change in terms both of training and officer sanctions to address some of these issues. We are extremely lucky today to have an all-star panel ready to talk about these issues, both from a research perspective and from a lived experience. So I will just get right started and talk to you about each of our guests today. First of all, Captain Joe Perez. He is the president of the Hispanic National Law Enforcement Association. He is retiring today as captain of the Prince George's County Police Department. That's after 25 years. And so he served in a number of different roles I think will all be really informative for us, starting as a parole officer, patrol officer, but also working in internal affairs and in training and education. So he's a really broad experience of different aspects of policing. He holds a BS and MS in management from Johns Hopkins University. Next to him is Dr. Nancy Levine, who is a vice president for justice policy at the Urban Institute. Her research publications include prisoner reentry, criminal justice technologies, crime prevention, policing, and the spatial analysis of crime and criminal behavior. A graduate of the LBJ School at the University of Texas at Austin, in addition, she has a PhD in criminal justice from Rutgers. She has also served in any number of important policy roles, including as executive director for the bipartisan Charles Colson Task Force on the Federal Corrections Reform. And Rayshawn Ray, my colleague here at Brookings. Dr. Rayshawn Ray is a David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, formerly a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Research Scholar at UC Berkeley. His research addresses the mechanisms that manufacture and maintain racial and social inequality, with a particular focus on police-civilian relations and men's treatment of women. He is, in addition, an associate professor of sociology and at the University of Maryland College Park, and is the executive director of the Lab for Applied Social Science Research. So let's give a round of applause to welcome our guests today. All right, so I want to start with a really broad question, and I hope it will lead to a fruitful discussion. What do you think are the biggest challenges that are facing us in terms of policing today? And I want to start with you, Mr. Perez.
First of all, good morning, and thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here. I could sit here and talk for 2 hours just about that one question, you know, just a little piece of it. But what I think the biggest challenges today are the culture of heavy-handed policing, which is condoned by the leadership, the executive leadership of most of these police departments. And I'll kind of give you an overview is that, you know, we begin the academy, and the first thing that we do at the training academy is we get these officers into the mindset of it's us against them in the community. And everything we do in training revolves around your safety. You know, we jump out from corners and we kidnap people during training to show them that, you know, there are threats out there and it's the community. So that, you know, that right there is what we got to change. We got to get away from that type of culture. And you got to remember, back in the day when it was even more heavy-handed, you know, these guys are now your leaders. These are your police chiefs. These are, you know, the sons of those people from back in the day, you know. So we got to get away from that.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, and that gets to recruitment, right?
Yes.
So who are you recruiting? And also the research literature talks about the differences between the warrior mentality and the guardian mentality. And I think you were talking about the traditional approach to policing is a warrior mentality. And so you think about who is attracted to a job where they identify as being a warrior, a protector of safety and justice. And you know, right there you could do some pretty good screening to find, you know, is that who we need on the front lines? Because it's not. The truth of the matter is that police are shouldered with all manner of societal ills. Whether fairly or not, they are probably the first to respond to all manner of problems, not necessarily public safety problems, but the problems that people encounter in the day-to-day lives. And this can include things like interacting with someone without a home who suffers from mental illness or responding to a lot of calls that are substance use overdoses. And, you know, they're not necessarily trained for that. They're trained to be warriors, and that's the problem right there. Recruiting different people who have different backgrounds and different philosophies. You know, a lot of the old guard talks about how, well, I didn't sign up to be a social worker, when in fact, what we need are more social workers in the policing field.
Yeah, I mean, I'll further double down on both of these great points. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the biggest challenge to policing today is a lack of police accountability. And Joe really spoke to it as it relates to the organizational structure and culture within police departments. You mentioned the Lab for Applied Social Science Research in Maryland. Several of them are here. We've done a lot of work over the years, from interviewing hundreds of police officers to doing dozens of implicit bias trainings to evaluating the implementation of body-worn camera programs. And unfortunately, these programs fall short because they don't really address the root causes of what leads to what we consider to be one of the most heinous acts, which are officer-involved shootings, particularly the disparity between African-Americans and whites. And so when we think about this, I think there are a couple of examples. One we were discussing earlier, which is when police departments have video footage, mm-hmm. when they have evidence that they could give the public, there is nothing that makes them or forces them to give up that information, mm-hmm. to actually be transparent with the public in a way that they want the public to be transparent with them. This erodes trust, and I think that's a fundamental problem. I think another good example of how we see a lack of police accountability is related to civil payouts. So, of course, we have recent incidents that we'll talk about, from the Amber Geiger situation to what recently happened with Mrs. Jefferson in Fort Worth. But oftentimes, officers aren't necessarily even brought to trial. Mm-hmm. Grand jury doesn't even indict. Mm-hmm. That is the norm. But what is also becoming the norm are civil payouts. And these civil payouts aren't anything that police departments or police officers are responsible for. Instead, these funds come from taxpayer dollars. So once again, we see people or a group of people or an entity, an organization as a police department commit an act, and they are essentially ameliorated from any of the consequences of that act, and the people who are held accountable for it are the same people who actually pay their salaries and taxpayers. Mm-hmm. So we see this conundrum where we see this lack of police accountability. And then we have departments like Chicago that actually appropriate funding for police brutality. This is something that when I talk to people in the city of Chicago, they have no idea about, and they're deeply disturbed by it. Mm-hmm. But these are the ways that police departments have not been held accountable. And it does a disservice not only to the public, but it also does a disservice to the men and women who put on that uniform, mm-hmm. who really want to protect and serve, and at times their own departments and organization work against them.
So I think every one of you raised this question of culture, and I think that can be something that's really hard for civilians like myself to understand, to sort of put yourself in the position of an officer. And so I was wondering if you would be willing to talk a little bit about your experiences, or the experiences, like what's the day-to-day like, both as the patrol officer, which I think is what most of us have in mind when we're thinking about day-to-day policing, but also from an administrative perspective.
Okay. Well, you know, as a patrol officer, you know, there is no, you know, there's no like one size fits all about what you're going to do from day to day. You know, sometimes you come into work, and before you get there, you know, we have take-home cruisers. So, you know, you could be driving to work in your cruiser in your uniform ready to go. You know, you start at 6:30 and it's 6 o'clock and you're on your way and you're already hearing calls on the radio that, you know, you may need to assist with. So there's days that you can go from call to call to call, you know, whether it's a domestic, whether it's an assault, a theft at 7-Eleven. You know, you could just go from call to call to call and then writing reports. And then other times, you know, you could be sitting for a long period of time. You know, you could just be, you know, waiting for something to happen and, you know, you're just conversating somewhere by the 7-Eleven. So, you know, there's no set thing that happens, but, you know, when you call to these dangerous situations or for dangerous people or incidents, you know, that's all of a sudden. That's a split second. You know, you might get called to like a bank robbery or something like that and happen to pull up when the guy is coming out with a gun, you know, and then you have to react. So you could go from 0 to 100, 110 in a matter of seconds, you know. And, you know, like I said, going back to the heavy-handed policing, all right, we're taught to, you know, the community is our enemy, you know. They don't say it, but, you know, in the way that they train us, they make us feel that way, you know. And, you know, you're a good officer, and you get rewarded if, you know, you make a lot of arrests, you know. And if you use force during those arrests, that, you know, that makes you a good officer. You know, the guys that are working community policing and are talking to businesses and they know everyone in the neighborhood, those people are not recognized, you know, because I guess because, you know, that's something that you don't really track. You know, you don't track the absence of crime. You know, you track the statistics. And, you know, the administrative people believe that heavy-handed policing really reduces crime, you know.
But that's not really true across the country, right? There are some progressive-minded police chiefs who are trying to instill a different kind of culture and response, right?
There's very few. I mean, there's very few that actually do it. I mean, they want you to go out
there. I think the challenge is that even if the chief is bought into a different way, a different culture, it's hard to have that permeate all the way down to line staff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Dr. Levine, I wonder if you want to jump in a little more and talk about what can be tracked, since, you know, what culture hard to track, but what are sort of metrics that are available to us?
Plenty could be tracked. Not much is tracked in a way that is easily available and publicly disseminated. I think that's the big problem, right? So we have recently at the Urban Institute finished up a 6-site evaluation of this thing called the National Initiative on Building Community Trust and Justice. It was an Obama-era, Eric Holder legacy project to instill training and in this concept called procedural justice, which is interacting with people in a respectful way, obviously in compliance with the law and constitutionally, but also explaining the reasons why you're pulling someone over, and also concepts of implicit bias, which of course we all have, but recognition of those biases and how they affect how we interact with people. And then this notion of reconciliation, which is essentially going to the communities that have the most fraught relationship with the police and vice versa, largely communities of color with long histories of tensions that date back to the police's role being complicit in looking the other way with lynchings, enforcing Jim Crow, you know, all the things that people wearing the uniform did back in the day, and owning the fact that because I wear this uniform, I know that I represent that, even if that isn't what I am or what I believe in. I want to hear from you. I want to understand how you experience policing. And I want to share what I'm trying to do differently. So I know that's not the answer to your question, but this initiative is really fascinating because we set out to try to evaluate it and had a really hard time doing it in a rigorous manner because of the lack of data mm-hmm. that we were able to acquire on things like use of force by race of citizen versus race of officer, and you know the types of things you really want to dig into. Very little data to work with. We ended up working with data derived from surveys of residents who live in those communities, and I can tell you more about that later.
Yeah, so this is really interesting to me, right? So not only can you, is it hard to track things like culture,
yeah.
that's really nebulous, but even stuff that you could be tracking, we're not necessarily making that kind of data available.
Correct.
I want to bring in Dr. Ray to talk about what I always think is some of the coolest data that's being collected, and so in particular on the question of officer mental health, right? So
mm-hmm.
we were talking about, you know, you're doing this job that's like, okay, I've got to, like, you know, deal with these incidences that are, like, at this level of energy, and then suddenly there's this mm-hmm. sudden bump up, and I've got to handle something really stressful.
Mm-hmm.
And so a bunch of your work addresses this question and those sort of implications for officer mental health. I just love to hear more about those projects.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think on the two fronts that were just made, I think part of the problem is that the reward structure is off.
Mm-hmm.
So the public wants a reward structure that actually is rewarding what we consider to be policing that might be reducing crime, when in-house, mm-hmm. the reward structure is about arrest and things. And so in many regards, we have deficit data. We don't have data on positive outcomes. So what we tried to do at Laser is we created a virtual reality decision-making program so that we can aim to determine what are positive factors that lead to outcomes that the general public, as well as police officers, consider to be good outcomes. So as an example, we know a lot about, well, we don't know enough about it because we pretty much only have data when it comes to officer-involved shootings from 16 states, give or take, depending on how you look at it. But overall, we don't have good information on what are the factors that don't necessarily lead to officers engaging in these type of acts.
Mm-hmm.
We have information at times, anecdotal, about what officers do. But what this program does is take officers into a virtual world
mm-hmm.
that allows for them to be immersed in a 360-degree environment. And we can measure a host of things, not only their behaviors, but we can also track their physiology, their eye movement, their heart rate, their stress level, their decision making, the distance that they might have to a character, their tone of voice, the words they use. And then we're able to give departments back information that says these are the officers that might be performing in ways that you might expect. And these are officers who are performing in different ways. And I think what's key is these are characteristics. You know, we can also get at attitudes. So we're not trying to pinpoint one particular officer. But I think what we are trying to do is say we're getting a lot of information on officers who do things that we consider to be bad. But we don't have any information on the officers who do things that we consider to be good. And that is ultimately what we need, because when it comes to training, we need to be able to replicate some of the characteristics that we see that are positive outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Could you imagine also using that at the point of recruitment?
Yes, of course.
Candidates?
Yeah, and this is what's interesting.
You're not waiting until after the fact. You're working with, you know, there's always going to be some share of bad apples, right?
Yep.
And screening them at the beginning could be really helpful, because once they're on the force, there's, I mean, you could speak to this, I'm sure. Very hard to find an exit for them.
Yeah, and the unfortunate part is that, you know, we cover up for the habitual offenders. Because usually the ones that are, you know, I can tell you this. I mean, I don't know any of these folks that are involved in any of these high-profile incidents across the country. But when people ask me, well, do you think that was wrong? Do you think, you know, what he did was egregious? And on the surface, yes. But I guarantee you that when you check these officers' backgrounds, they've been involved in other stuff, you know, and it's been stuff that we swept under the rug. Mm-hmm. And I'm giving you that from the internal affairs perspective.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Because in internal affairs, I was in there as a sergeant, which is low level, just investigating officers, to a captain where I was the commander. I wasn't the top person. There was one more above me, where I had a little more influence on these cases. And what I always saw as I was going up the ranks was, you know, you get an officer that always got the same complaint, the same type of use of force with 10 different people,
yep.
10 different incidents. And right away, what you hear from the top when it goes up the chain of command is, oh, he's a hard charger. He's a good worker, you know. Mm. And then
there's
they sweep it up.
There's a lot of protection.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And had we done what we were supposed to do from the beginning, you know, we may have prevented some of these high-profile incidents.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is the question that we need better data, or would better data not help? Because when you have this information, it's not getting acted on, at least in some instances.
Well, more transparency, right?
Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, there are civilian oversight boards in many jurisdictions. Some of them have a lot more power than others, but requiring the public dissemination of this type of data is what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. Need to shine a bright light on this. The more the data gets out there, the more we can hold police agencies accountable.
Well, and you, are there sort of incidents where you've seen data be used well, or at times where you're like, if we could have gotten this data used correctly, it would have made a difference?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about fighting crime, you know, we have, nowadays, we have a lot of data. We can tell you where crime is located. We could pinpoint it down to, you know, a small area, a time of day, you know, so that works well. And in my opinion, you know, the cameras work well as well.
The body cameras,
the mobile, yeah, the mobile video cameras, they work very well, you know, and I think that kind of keeps people honest. You know what I'm saying? And like I said, the bad apples, all right, they're always going to do what they're going to do, whether there's a camera or not. But for the rest of us, you know, when you know that that camera's there, then you know, you might think twice before you lose it. You know, you're having a bad day, you know that camera's there, you might think twice.
What's interesting is that the research doesn't necessarily bear that out.
Right.
The very early evaluations suggested, yes, that cameras have what's called a civilizing effect on both officers and the people they interact with. But then subsequent studies suggested not so much, including, I think, the largest and most rigorous study that occurred right here in D.C. So what does that mean? Does it mean we should stop investing in this technology?
And I could tell you, at least from my experience, you know, Prince George's County Police Department was one of the early adopters of the mobile cameras. And officers, and you know, the thing is, and it starts at the top. The command staff, you know, did it because they had to do it, you know. And then when it trickled down, when we're presenting you the cameras and we're saying, okay, we have to do this because of the Department of Justice or for whatever reason, you know, that minimizes the importance of that camera, you know. But when I was a patrol officer and they put that camera in the car, I loved it. I loved it because there were so many times, more often than not, that I would walk up to a person after, you know, during a traffic stop, and they would cuss at me and moan and groan and say all this stuff, and I would tell them, you know, you're being recorded, there's a camera, audio, visual, you know, we had a spiel. I said that, and 9 times out of 10, they would look back, and, you know, all of a sudden,
yeah,
it would calm down. So I always thought that the cameras were great. And then also, when it later on, as I moved up the ranks, when we came to internal affairs, we always looked for the camera. Mm-hmm. And again, 9 times out of 10 on some of these minor complaints, when people say, yeah, he called me whatever, we'd go back and look at the tape. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, he didn't say that.
So well, what great. If there is no tape?
And that, and,
like,
and
in
that's
the case
a whole
of body
different.
Cameras, I don't know if this is common knowledge, but officers have the discretion to activate those cameras or not. They're not running 24/7. Mm-hmm. So at what point in time are they thinking, oh, time to activate my camera?
Right.
Policies vary widely across the country. Mm-hmm. When they're in that, like, most extreme fight or flight mode, it's probably the last thing they're thinking about, mm-hmm. or they're strategically not turning it on.
Yeah.
So it's like this almost false promise.
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there clearly have been instances where, at minimum, what body cameras have done is made the public aware of things that they normally don't get the chance to see. Whether that actually resulted in accountability,
right,
not clear very much at all. But I want to bring in Dr. Ray, who I know has been doing some thinking on this question.
Yeah, I mean, I think really what we're talking about is policy implementation versus cultural change. So chiefs are forward-facing people. They're like elected officials. They typically get appointed by the mayor, the county executive, or what have you. So they come up with a strategic plan, policy changes on what to implement. And they want to get the public in particular all excited. We're going to implement body-worn cameras. We're going to do implicit bias training for the whole department. We're going to do all these things. Yeah, but the people who are implementing it are the captains, lieutenants, the sergeants. And they're sitting up saying, yeah, you're the seventh chief, the seventh chief I've had.
We can wait this out.
Yeah, yeah, you're coming and going. So it's similar to what we've seen in other social institutions where we have a policy mandated from a particular level but implemented at a lower level. And we see that kind of across the board. So I think that's one thing to think about. I think the other thing to think about is when it comes to body-worn cameras, yes, it's provided more transparency. But to Nancy's point, it hasn't necessarily shown that it's changed behavioral outcomes. But that's interesting for me as a social psychologist because police officers think that it has, even though it hasn't necessarily changed their behavior. So it's a disconnect between attitudes and actual behaviors, which suggests, to Joel's point, when they're sitting in the car, they might be thinking consciously, oh, yeah, these things matter for me. And then the minute they turn those sirens on, the minute they get the call, they go into a particular mode that they behave a particular way based on the way they've been trained to do for so long. Mm-hmm. And I think really when we look at when we've seen change in policing, it's typically when we've seen some type of federal oversight. So, I mean, consent decrees is really when we see it. And why do we see it? Because if departments don't adhere to that, they actually lose funding. So, see, that's accountability. Typically, when we see the changes is when we actually see accountability. And, yes, in most cameras, officers have the ability to turn them on and off. I mean, people can argue whether they should be able to do that. Some you turn on, they roll back 30 seconds. But I know Taser has a model, for example, that stays on 24/7 and you can actually see it live when they're actually doing it. The problem is that those are really, really expensive cameras. Large departments oftentimes don't have the funding or the infrastructure to use them. Mid-sized departments do. And so that's been
also objected to.
Oh, yeah. The unions definitely object to that. And I think that's something we haven't talked about at unions.
Right to privacy during their shift. I mean,
yeah, without a doubt.
They need to take bathroom breaks.
Yeah, and then they might go into a place that needs to be private.
Yeah.
And, you know, officers having the discretion to do that could be really, really important. But that's something we haven't talked about is the union. I mean, we're putting all the emphasis on the internal organizational culture of the department. But the Fraternal Order of Police becomes another beast in a sense where definitely, unions are extremely important, particularly for protecting members and members' rights. But when it comes to policing, we see a different outcome. So as an example, what just happened in Fort Wayne, when I asked people, what was the first thing you noticed when that incident happened? And people said all kind of stuff. But there's one thing studying police that I really noticed. FOP told the officer to resign. Why did they say that? Because in some states, if you get fired, you can't work again. In some states, you actually can. But if you resign, even if something happens, you have the ability to go work again. And like with the Tamir Rice situation, with the incident in Pittsburgh, we've seen that where these officers had worked for other departments and, to Joel's point, had a behavior of engaging in these type of acts. And the organizational culture allowed them to proliferate and move on. They get emboldened. Like when you get away with something, you don't all of a sudden say, "Whoo, that was lucky. I got away with that." No, you say, "I got away with that. I might do that again. Mm-hmm. And I might do it worse the next time." That's just the way in which we're socialized to think.
Maybe, Mr. Perez, you can talk a little more about the relationship between the sort of the union and the official leadership, because I think that's something that from the outside is really hard to perceive.
Well, you know, what's funny is typically, you know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but typically the police chief and the unions are kind of adversarial, you know, because, you know, the union's protecting the members, you know, and the police chief supposed to be protecting the community, serving the community. And, you know, I think that it becomes a problem when the two are so close together. You know, in our agency, you know, every time the police chief does something or holds a press conference, the union's standing right there with them. You know, and, you know, the relationship is too cozy. So when you have to do something, when you have to discipline somebody for doing something they shouldn't do, then do you actually do it or do you work out agreements with the union? You know, like most agencies don't have that tightness with the unions. And it's you know, I understand the union and, you know, as a captain, you elect to be a union member or not. And I am a member. You know, because they protect your rights if you need them. But, you know, there has to be a happy medium somewhere, you know.
Now, you've talked a little bit, Dr. Ray, about changing funding structures, and I wonder if you think that that might help address this question of the relationship with the union and the leadership, or like the sort of costs associated with particular incidents of malfeasance or misconduct.
Yes, I do. I mean, I think changing funding structures will matter a lot. So, again, currently, when there is a use of force incident, not only, of course, does the jurisdiction, the county or the city or what have you, or the state if it's at the state level, now represent the officer in the police department. That makes sense. But then when there is a civil payout, when the criminal justice system finds the police department or the police officer liable, taxpayers also take that burden on. Police departments don't. Mm-hmm. Unlike, say, in a medical model, where a physician might do something, we consider it, you know, malpractice and other sorts of things, and it's not always intentional when they do it either. Sometimes things happen, but insurance covers that. And then based on the likelihood of more incidents occurring at that hospital or with that physician, premiums go up, costs go up. So now all of a sudden that leads to changes because you're hitting the hospital in its pocket. That doesn't happen with police departments currently. And people have touted other types of solutions, like maybe you deal with FOP dues or maybe you deal with pensions. I mean, I tend to think that police officers are underpaid and overstressed and overworked to begin with. So going that direction might not necessarily be the best way to do it. But I do think that there are additional ways to hold police officers and police departments accountable, because you have certain places like in Nebraska, a rural area in Nebraska, there was a big civil payout issue where it was a lot of people who were falsely accused of a crime. And the city went bankrupt because it didn't have the money to pay out the civil penalty. And so we see this across the board. Smaller departments could band together as kind of a conglomerate in a sense. We see this in other social institutions. We see this organizationally. I don't know why we think we can't see it when it comes to police. And I think part of it is the lack of transparency. Like when I tell people that taxpayer money pays out civil payouts, the look on their faces when I tell them that is utter shock. And they're thinking, why have I never heard of this before? You know, and to your point, I think something you asked me about earlier that I want to quickly mention is about officer mental health. Mm-hmm. This is something that we don't talk a lot about. And doing this work, I mean, I've seen all of these policy changes that happen. And we're making all these changes, but we don't focus on the person. And as a person who has a lot of police officers in his family, I mean, I know the impact that the job can have. I think it's probably the most dangerous job we have, mentally, physically, emotionally, in a lot of different ways. And there's a recent study that came out. I've been preliminarily playing around with the data, and what they show is that 80% of officers have some type of chronic stress, depression, anxiety, sleep problems, marital problems, relationship problems. And nearly 1 out of 6 are suicidal, and 1 out of 6 have substance abuse problems. Mm-hmm. But 90% never go seek help. This is another example of how we see the organizational culture mm-hmm. working against people to create this warrior environment. If you go see a psychologist, then supposedly you're weak. You're weak-minded. Instead of, it should be normalized that going to see a psychologist might actually make you a better officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some cases, there are real professional consequences for these kids. For seeking help for that kind of thing, right?
I mean, without a doubt. And I know Joe could talk about that. I mean, the consequences become, if you're not ruled capable of going back out, you get put on desk duty. And getting put on desk duty, and you hear that statement in the news, right? Administrative duty, that's not a good thing. And so when that happens all of a sudden, if you're not clear, that's put in your personnel file. So now all of a sudden, when Nancy comes up for promotion, I look in her file and I'm like, I don't know, this thing happened a few years ago. Instead, I think what we need is to normalize it. This is part of changing the culture. Instead of just going to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist after a use of force incident, officers should go every 90 days. It should be normalized that they should go multiple times a year. So now all of a sudden, when I see Joe in the office, I don't think something bad just happened to him. Instead, I just think, oh, this is just his quarterly time to go. I think these are the types of changes we need, because if we want police officers to adequately protect and serve, we actually have to give them the human resources to protect and serve themselves.
Mr. Perez, do you have thoughts about how you've seen that play out
in
the world?
And like our particular agency, you know, if you use force, you have to see the psychologist, you know. And, you know, I think, like Dr. Ray says, that doesn't go far enough. You know, I don't know what the time limit should be, especially when you have a large agency. You know, we have 1,700 officers, so putting them through every couple months may not be feasible, you know. But, you know, there should be, you know, we go to in-service training once a year. Maybe once a year, you know, you're set to go, you know. And it's not so much of a burden. And I know Dr. Ray in particular has been around a lot of officers. Mm-hmm. Just imagine, most people see officers as stoic, you know, and kind of unapproachable and stuff like that. But once you start talking to officers, they'll tell you all kinds of stuff, you know, in reality. You know it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you make them go once a year, you know, there's a possibility that they can go in there and tell the psychiatrist, hey, you know, I'm having these issues. And then that gives management a tool to maybe give this guy a break. You know, maybe he's in a particular unit that's high stress.
Yeah.
Let's put him somewhere, some administrative assignment where, you know, he's doing statistics or policies, you know, policy and research, something like that. And then the second piece of that, it has to be two pieces. And maybe I wasn't really clear on this, but the leadership, all right, when they put the policy out, all right, you have to make sure that people understand mm-hmm. that that's what you really want. You're not just saying it. You know what I'm saying? Like when you implement implicit bias training and then you tell people behind the scenes that it's not important or you insinuate that it's not important, you know, how do you think that officer is going to react? Oh, we're just doing this because we have to. It's not important. So, you know, good policy, but also, you know, the leader sets the tone. He has the set the tone that this is what I want and this is important.
So you said something just now. It's the word he. And I was sitting here thinking about how there's an increasing number of female chiefs as well as women in rank and file positions. I'm curious. I'm not an expert, but I'm curious of my fellow panelists, like whether you think that will change the culture in any way.
I've worked for quite a few women in law enforcement, and I'll be honest with you. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to profile a little bit. But women have been more compassionate, more detailed, you know, in my experience, compared to some of the men. We got that macho attitude about how we got to do things. And women are more, I don't know, you know, they think things through. The ones that I've worked with. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time that I've been transferred and, you know, you see it on the transfer list that you're going to work for this woman, you'll hear male officers. Yeah. Oh, man, you're going to work for her. Oh, I've always enjoyed and prefer to work for a woman because, you know, they were more balanced for the most part. And I'm not saying that that's all of them, but the ones that I've worked for have been great. And I think that would be a piece of changing that culture.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting because I think gender obviously matters. It always does, similar to race. And in a profession where we've seen so few women, obviously, we can think that it would matter more. And I think it matters in a few ways. One is optics do matter. So even if we don't see outcome change, it's kind of like body-worn cameras. The fact that they are there, they matter in some ways. I think the second way is what Joe just mentioned about policy and administration. Okay, that's another way in which we might see a change. But then another way we might see gender mattering is as it relates to actually on the street and interacting with people, which is, I think it's an empirical question. And I think the question is still out. I mean, we have some evidence to suggest preliminarily that maybe when it comes to actually interacting with people on the street, that maybe gender doesn't matter as much. Mm-hmm. It could matter during the interaction in different ways, but in terms of how the officers behave, if they're trained the same way, we can think of why it might not matter as much as we might think. I think the other thing is hegemonic masculinity impacts men and women. Mm-hmm. So no matter who you indoctrinate into a particular cultural environment mm-hmm. That you train people to be a warrior, women are going to respond to that similarly. So while doing administrative desk work where you're implementing policy and thinking through that, we might see different aspects of our childhood socialization come up as it relates to gender. But when it comes to, say, use of force and interacting with people, we might see gender not mattering as much, but it's an empirical question.
In the literature on race,
without a doubt, yeah.
Well, where you know a lot of people say, mm-hmm. "Oh, we just the the officers need to more represent the demographics of the community that they're serving.
Doesn't change anything.
The research suggests that, what is the saying, that blue trumps black, essentially, that once you affiliate with the police culture, that is the overriding factor in how you interact with residents.
Without a doubt. And we have some research on this. So we've had officers go through implicit association tests. We're currently analyzing another round of data. But some that we've had over the past few years, we had some police recruits who were at different levels. Some were just coming in. Some were farther along in their process. And we have them take implicit association tests, which for those who don't know, these are tests that can get at people's unconscious biases. They either they don't want to admit to, or at times they don't necessarily know that they have. Mm-hmm. I would suggest everyone go do them. You can search IAT and Harvard and you can go through it. Yeah, all of us have them in different ways. And what we found is that officers, regardless of race, were more likely to associate weapons with African-Americans than they were whites with African-Americans. And it didn't matter whether or not the officer was white, black, a man or a woman. We've seen that same pattern. But because optics matter, people want to see police officers represent their community. And it could be something to that beyond race, which isn't necessarily just about race, but it could be about how racial segregation and classism operate in our society. So if you take an officer who's from a neighborhood and now they're going back to that neighborhood, that could matter. So we could think all of where you're from. You intimately know the neighborhood. You know people. So we might be actually using race as a proxy for how neighborhood segregation actually operates, which I think would get to something as it relates to community policing. Because right now, officers can't afford to live where they work. So not only do you have them stressed out at work, they're overworked, they're underpaid, then they can't afford to, like, officers can't afford to live in D.C. Shoot, most of us can't afford to live in D.C. So, I mean, then you put officers and you put them here. And then part of what happens is now they're living an hour away. Like we were talking about how we get to work earlier today. And so if you've been on a shift and you've worked a night shift and then you go home and you got to take your kids to school, then you got to come right back to work, and then you got to drive another 30 minutes to the district where you're at. Just think about how exhausted you are and how tired you are, and then give a person a weapon and the authority to do something to someone else.
And then not having the knowledge of the community because you don't reside.
Exactly.
Although I imagine that could go two ways, right? Because on the one hand, you could be, if you come from that community, you could be a role model. You understand better the issues and challenges. But on the other hand, I imagine it could also expose an officer to corruption.
Well, I mean, it definitely could. And I think in cities like Baltimore, for example, I mean, I think we've seen that. And not only in Baltimore, but that's the one that's kind of closest to us and around the country. And I think part of what it does is we talk about community policing. We talk about officers getting out their car, like playing basketball with kids. Like when I think about community, like that's nice. That's just having fun, doing something nice. When I think about community policing, I think about being engulfed in that environment on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And we actually see that oftentimes in predominantly white and affluent neighborhoods where officers live there. And part of what happens there when they police there is it leads to them having a slight pause to think of who they're interacting with. So they interact with someone and they think, you know, this person kind of looks like one of the dads in my kid's school. Or she looks like the woman when I walk into my favorite restaurant who greets me. So that slight pause, you know, this person looks like one of the people who I go to church with. Those slight pauses are things that happen for white and black officers, Latino officers as well, in predominantly white neighborhoods that don't happen in less affluent neighborhoods that are black and brown neighborhoods. And I think that slight pause is how we see implicit bias playing out. So we always talk about policing as a black and brown deficit. And obviously research bears that out. But I think it's also another side, and being honest about it, it's in many ways a white advantage. Like we see whites getting certain types of deference. So this is the reason why we don't see the grand jury bringing more charges, because when you actually look at the policies that are in place, officers did what they were trained to do when they interact with black and brown people. As the public, we just have a problem with that. Like we think it was too much force, but it was actually in line with what they do. It's when they don't do things. So as an example, Leonard Shand in Prince George's County, who was shot by 10 officers from three different departments. He had knives. From my perspective, he clearly had a mental illness. He was not treated that way. So officers then viewed him as a person who was being noncompliant. It changed their rules and procedure for dealing with him. On the other hand, you had another white man in another state who also had knives, who were coming at police, who they viewed as being mentally ill. They didn't use any force on him. Mm-hmm. Now, people look at that and they say it's race. It's not just race. It's the intersection between race and mental illness, and the fact that African Americans and Latinos are less likely to be diagnosed with a mental illness. And the gap in police shootings between blacks and whites is just as big, if not greater, between the gap of people who have a mental illness versus people who don't.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that, because I think that when we're talking about communities that are experiencing kind of over-policing, right, the use of force, they're also experiencing under-policing a lot of the time, right? They're not, you know, it's the same communities that see, these incidents of violence against local community members by the police, and also crimes are not getting solved often, right? So it's a really problematic dynamic that is happening simultaneously. I wonder if you, actually, we'll start with you, Dr. Levine. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the data work that you've been doing on the getting the actual police work done, right? Because we've been focusing a lot on the use of force, but like the gunshot detection, other sorts of technologies that might be helpful in terms of, because communities both want police to behave respectfully and also crimes to get solved, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my colleagues and I at the Urban Institute are just wrapping up, or actually did wrap up, an evaluation of gunshot detection technology in three cities. I geek out on police technologies, not
you're
because
in the right
they're
place.
Cool,
bring it.
Yeah,
but because I've been doing this for a long time, and it's kind of like Groundhog Day. Cops love their new shiny toys, and they always want to acquire the next thing that's going to be that silver bullet. And so, like, many years ago, I did one of the largest studies in the U.S. on public surveillance cameras. I've done a lot of work on body cameras, and, of course, gunshot detection technology is another one of these new, exciting, like, oh, this is going to solve violent crime, right? Mm-hmm. It's way more complicated than that, and I think across all the evaluations of technology I've done, the one common factor is that the technology is most likely to work when the police agency is very thoughtful and intentional about the policies behind how the technology is used, engaging the community before deployment, explaining what it is and what it isn't, and really spending a lot of time on training and then holding officers accountable on how that technology is used and how it is not supposed to be used. And by and large, most agencies fall short on one or more of those factors.
Mm-hmm. So this comes back again to the question of implementation. It makes me a little sad about the... I'm gonna do one more question, then I'm going to throw it out to the audience to start thinking up your questions for the panel. So we've been talking a lot about the challenges of implementation of policy, right? And that just seems like this huge barrier to getting good policy. You know, good policies put in place, it doesn't matter if you don't implement, right? Mm-hmm. But let's take a step back and what are the policy changes that we want to see on, things like use of force, things like, better detection of where crime is occurring, or like what pieces, if implemented well, would make a difference? Let's start there. And then we can talk about some of the implementation pieces.
I'm kind of more interested in talking about like what the role of police should be, and whether we need as much policing as we have, and whether other people can serve some of the roles that police are currently serving.
So that's the change. The change would be shifting away from policing towards
social
work models.
Are there models or solutions that can be developed by communities so that they can own their definition of safety and how to resolve a lot of problems that right now are not getting resolved by police? And I don't think any manner of policy change is going to change an entire culture. Very complicated.
So are there places where there's been a move in the direction that you're talking about in terms of shifting away from a policing model to a different kind of model of ensuring safety and security?
There's seeds of efforts across the country, but nothing that I've seen that spans an entire jurisdiction. There's a lot of people who reside in these heavily policed communities, largely black and brown communities, that, as you said, feel like, you're there pulling us over, stopping, frisking, arresting us for these low-level crimes, and you're not solving the violence that we're all experiencing, the trauma we experience, the vicarious trauma, all of that. And we want to develop our own solutions. Mm-hmm. And we think we know better what our community needs. Mm-hmm. So I think that seeding more innovation in that regard would be very welcome.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Dr.
I want to make a quick point on this, because this is a very, very important point. what we found is that part of what's happening is that when these changes happen, these policy changes happen in the implementation, they're primarily oftentimes solely put on police officers to implement them. Mm-hmm. And they oftentimes don't have the skill set mm-hmm. or the person power to do it. So part of what we're doing is, this, I mean, look, I do statistics, and it's one of those things where if you don't know statistics, but somebody gives you a data set to analyze it, you're not going to be able to do anything with it. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what we're doing with police officers. So we say, here's this new shiny toy. Now go figure out how to use it without a whole bunch of instructions, without a president. And then we wonder why it doesn't do well. Instead, I think we need not only more federal oversight to deal with establishing national standards, but then we also need local communities to partner with police departments in more deliberate ways to think about what does safety and protection look like in our community, which is different from calling it policing, mm-hmm. right? Which then deals with surveillance and over-policing. So mm-hmm. the concepts and the terminology we use are so key. So back to your original question, there in local communities, there are so many resources for people who have these varying skill sets who can partner with police departments. But police departments, and some are open to partnering with the community, but overall they're not, and they're not made to. And I think that's something that could happen, because oftentimes when we've seen these consent decrees, they have had to do things in the community. And I think that has been a large part of the change as well, because they actually hear from people. When we would do these implicit bias trainings with police departments, we'd bring in data about what the community thought. They literally had no idea mm-hmm. that that's what the community thought. And it's because police officers primarily deal with, as they say, good people on their worst days. So they're just interacting with negativity oftentimes on a regular basis, because they're sitting in their cars, because they have all this additional paperwork. They have 40 to 50 pounds of stuff on them now that they got to carry around. I mean, people don't really realize the daily stresses. And this is part of the mental health challenges that officers face. But there are community resources that could help police officers with their mental health problems as well. They're just literally not being used. Mm-hmm.
Surprised, do you have thoughts about things you've seen?
Yeah.
At least optimistic?
Optimistically, I can tell you, like, Montgomery County, my last assignment was planning and research, and I went to quite a few body-worn camera meetings and planning sessions and stuff like that. And, like, since I have that IA background, you know, my default is more oversight. You know, mm-hmm. and what I noticed with Montgomery County is that their body cameras are uploaded, but the state's attorney has that instant access to that mm-hmm. video. All right. So now they don't have to ask the police department, hey, mm-hmm. Officer Jones had an incident. Can I get that video? No, they log on and they get it themselves. They have interns. When they explained all this to me, I was like, wow, that's great. You know, that is awesome right there. They got interns that sit there because it's a lot of hours of video. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's overwhelming. But they explain they have all these interns that come in and review this stuff, and then they flag it. Then an attorney looks at it. I mean, the process was, it was so progressive. And I'll tell you, I mentioned this to our command staff in one of our meetings for the body-worn camera policy. And, you know, you would have thought that I cursed at somebody's mom or something like that, because they were like, no, you know, this is my data. No, we need to look at it first. Mm. No, you know, we need control of this. We're going to only give out what, you know, like, and I was like, you know, I just couldn't understand that mindset. So I think that would be more oversight in certain policies. And, you know, another flaw in the video and body camera, because you talked about turning them off. Mm-hmm. But you know what? If you have more people with body cameras, more people with cruiser cams, mm-hmm. come on, there's going to be one or two that are going to follow the rules.
Well, and there's actual technology now where the camera will automatically activate yep. as an officer exits his or her patrol car. Yep. Or if an officer's camera activates, all the cameras on officers in the immediate vicinity activate as well. Mm-hmm. And you can even carry that further. You yeah. could link it to biometrics if they all wore these fancy watches.
Exactly.
And you knew that all of a sudden their pulse rate went, you know, accelerated.
Exactly.
activate the camera. Or when the revolver leaves the holster, activate that camera. There are ways to use technology, I think, to get what we want out of body cameras.
Yeah. I'm going to do one quick follow-up on that, just because you said revolver leaves the holster, and it reminded me, I wanted to ask you guys about use of force standards, if you have specific thoughts about how those should be changed. I mean, we were talking generally speaking about changing the attitude in trainings, but are there specific things that happen at the moment of an incident that we think should be operating differently?
I mean, I think one big thing, and to this point about being able to track when weapons are moved and these sort of things, this is what we've been doing with virtual reality. We have trackers on weapons that tell us when officers pull them, when they shoot them, down to the millisecond. This technology is available, and police departments know that it's available. And instead of using it because it will improve policing, they're actually scared of it. Because they think that some kind of way is going to vilify them. But really what they think is that it's going to expose the skeletons in this organizational culture that would lead to massive changes in policing. But as it relates to use of force standards, again, I think that there has to be some type of a federal standard, like the Department of Justice, NIJ, Congress needs to get involved. Because right now, what happens if something happens in California? We were talking about the unfortunate incident in Fresno, where after 2 years, some video just came to light. Why is the public just now knowing about that a 16-year-old got shot in the head 2 years later after a civil suit now comes forward? So there needs to be federal standards. And sometimes it's not exactly about what officers do in the moment, even though I think that needs to be changed a little bit. So, for example, one thing people don't realize is, first, research shows that departments that have more use of force standards, in other words, more de-escalation tactics, that their outcomes are actually lower. And you have, meaning, in other words, if you have more options, taser, even a baton, which they don't use that much anymore, but other types of deployments, and if they actually implement de-escalation standards where they aim to create time with space, then all of a sudden you see a smaller gap in, say, racial disparities, for example. So we need federal use of standards. There are departments around the country that are doing this well, and then there are states and cities like Phoenix, Arizona, that are doing this horribly. I mean, their number of officer-involved shootings has almost tripled and quadrupled over the past, like, 5 to 10 years. I mean, these are things that should really concern everyone. And so I think there have to be federal oversight. I think the second thing is, when it comes to use of force, the big thing people don't realize is when officers deploy their less lethal options, oftentimes they have to be within a certain distance. So they might actually compromise their distance from people because they want to deploy a less lethal option. And then if that doesn't work properly, then they're oftentimes forced, based on their training, to go to a more lethal option. And these are that's a conundrum, I mean, that has to be worked through. And I don't really think people understand the complexities of policing that kind of lead to those outcomes. So in other words, you have a direct consequence, and then it leads to an unintended consequence that might actually make it worse.
All right, I'm going to open it up to the audience. Can we get some folks with questions here? Sir, I saw you first with the tie. Yes. Is there a microphone so that everyone can hear? Oh, here we are. Sorry, I was so quick to get this started. And this gentleman right here with the yellow tie.
Hi, Carl Golvin, retired special agent, U.S. Customs. I spent my last 6 years in internal affairs. And I wonder, I was even indoctrinated using the term law enforcement officer, training at Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. I wonder if just the mindset of considering ourselves to be peace officers first rather than law enforcement, keeping the peace being the primary objective even of the law, and that the standard to measure any event as successful is whether the minimum amount of force necessary to resolve the situation and prevent its reoccurrence has been used. Captain Perez, if I could ask you to specifically contrast, is there a difference in these issues between police departments and sheriff's offices concerning particularly the political accountability of each, whereas sheriffs, usually the sheriff is an elected official, and hence maybe the officers or deputies are more accountable to the population versus police chiefs who are usually politically appointed by politicians?
I don't have any data to tell you one way or the other, but it seems that policing is kind of similar across the board. You know, I mean, we're all facing the same types of issues, and you know, I think you're right. It goes back to what I was saying, how we train people in the academy, you know, that everyone's our enemy and, you know, you got to watch your back at all times. You know, somebody's going to jump out of this dark corner and get you. And you know, we need to, you know, like use different words, you know, like peace officers, you know, we're there for the police, for the peace, you know. And so you make a good point with that. And
I mean, words matter, you know, and when you change concepts, then you start to change definitions. Mm-hmm. And then it starts to change culture and structure. And to your point, like one big thing that we noticed when we were studying police officers is they rarely ever had the time to be off. And what I mean by that, even when you all are off duty, a lot of places make it mandatory for officers to carry their guns and their badge with them at all times. So when they go out to eat with their family, they're trying to find the corner of the restaurant where their back is to the place. And you're laughing because I'm sure you've done this. And yeah, this is what you do always. So when are you ever off? And so when we talk about what we call things, I think the change isn't only about officers interacting with the public, but it's also about officers interacting with one another and aiming to humanize them in a way that we haven't done in a very, very long time.
Other questions? I want to make a specific request that if you're from a group that tends to be underrepresented in how much you talk, maybe you talk today. Can you jump in? Okay. Hands up. You, sir, over here.
Right behind you so folks can help.
Hi, I wanted to see if you all can convey or share some of your experience and views with predictive policing that leverage analytics, biometrics, algorithms, and their effects on over-policing, under-policing, race relations, because I think there's a general consensus that we don't do a very good job of capturing crime. We do a very good job of capturing crime that police report.
Great question.
That's a great question. Go ahead.
Well, so I kind of entered the field of criminology doing a lot of work in the spatial analysis of crime. Mm-hmm. And even back then, we did some predictive spatial analyses to see, you know, what data best predicts where crime and when will it happen next. And I think what remains true today that we learned then is that the best predictor is where crime already happened. But that crime is not necessarily valid, right? Because mm-hmm. most of the crime data we have is generated in large part by where officers are, mm-hmm. right? Where they patrol, who they pull over, what crimes come to the attention of law enforcement. So basically using these predictive algorithms to say, okay, the crime will be here in this neighborhood at this time, let's send more officers over, just perpetuates a lot of this heavy police presence and biased policing.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, technology has a host of positives that could happen, but when it comes to policing, it has potentially a lot of advancements can actually lead to racial profiling and over-policing. So, I mean, not only do you have hotspot policings, but you have facial recognition. You now have the ability to use a private residence's camera that they have for their in-home security system and access it at times without even telling them. You have the ability to track license plates. And to Nancy's point, part of the problem is that when police officers are oftentimes looking for crime, and even though they say they don't have quotas, we know that they oftentimes do have quotas. And what that means is they're going to go to places where people are more exposed. And it follows the same pattern that we've seen with racial profiling, that oftentimes when they target people, so they're making stops, they're talking to people, at times brutalizing them. So a study of 700,000 police stops a few years ago in New York City found that over 50% of the stops from stop and frisk involved some type of physical force, and overwhelmingly the victims of these were blacks and Latinos, that roughly 98% of the time they didn't find anything, a previous criminal record, nor was the person doing anything. So it begs the question about technology. It's two points. First point is whether or not the technology is really put in place to reduce crime, or whether or not it's put in place to actually surveil people more. And as part of that surveillance happens, as technology continues to go, the unregulation of technology is highly problematic. It's like the Wild Wild West right now. Like, there's really no regulation, no standards that's going on. And I mean, we really have to figure that out.
Sir, up here in the maroon sweater.
Hi, Sarab Sangvi. Dr. Reyes touched on this a little bit, but I'm interested in your all's thoughts on consent decrees, and particularly with this past administration, it hasn't got a lot of focus, certainly with new consent decrees, but there are existing ones, and I'm curious what takes you have on the effectiveness that they've had, even while they're, it's a more quiet space in the last 3 years, and then also looking forward, if a new administration comes in with maybe a reinvigorated focus on that, what's the opportunity there and what we would see that from picking up from where they were a few years ago?
And I could touch on that just slightly. From being on the inside during a consent decree, I think it's important because it helps us in a couple ways. You know, again, it helps us in accountability. And, you know, with consent decrees, they also provide monies for things like body cameras, you know, and also they kind of, I hate to use the word force, but, you know, you're forced to make policy changes that they approve of. So what it actually does is it makes us better. You know, that's what I've seen. And the minute you take them away, then you start, you know, I think these incidents starts occurring more often.
I think that's right. And I've known more than one chief to say, I really would love a consent decree, which sounds crazy, but it's because, you know, many chiefs in big city police departments are reform-minded, but they're balancing this, you know, pushing reform and having the support of the rank and file. So when they're forced to comply with a consent decree, they get what they want, but it's not them. So they can say, sorry, guys, but we got to comply with this. I will also say there's at least one article I'm aware of that looks at the effect of consent decrees and finds that agencies that were subject to them were more likely to engage in reforms versus those who were not.
Yeah, I mean, I think I completely agree. The chiefs who I've worked with, I mean, they've really aimed to be reformist. But the organizational culture at times has restrained them from being able to do the things that they wanted to do. And I think people don't really realize why consent decrees matter. So the Department of Justice, not only do they send out this list of things that a department has to do, and then they allocate funding for different things, but then they mandate that you have to interact with certain entities. So it might be a research data arm. It might be a community arm. Mm-hmm. And then, really importantly, they oftentimes put an inspector general appointed by the Department of Justice to go into the department, work into the department, and make sure that that's implemented. When I've interacted with departments that have had these inspector generals, which are mostly lawyers who know the law, who study also criminal justice, that's really where you see the movement. The minute those people are gone, I mean, you see the lack of accountability that happens because that person is reporting to the Department of Justice. They're not reporting to the chief. And that particular part of accountability is extremely, extremely important for police departments.
Ma'am.
I want to kind of link to issues that you guys talked about in terms of accountability, and also the idea of like communities determining what they need in terms of safety and protection. I've been to some meetings for Black Lives Matter here in DC, and they have engaged in a project that I think they call Cop Watch, where they essentially train people to kind of like surveil the police when police are getting called into their neighborhoods to essentially like provide counter narratives that they're hoping that can help hold the police accountable. So my question in thinking about like policy and moving forward and giving communities more agency is how effective do you guys think similar programs like that could be? And also what is the likelihood that they might be taken seriously?
So the way I think about it, I think it's a couple things. I think on one hand, some police officers would say that, say, a cop watch program could at times endanger other people because people are coming up and watching. At the same time, though, having additional people to observe, similar to the way body cams operate, mm-hmm. can be extremely important. And I think layering it up to, say, community or civilian oversight committees, which is mm-hmm. taking off around the country. I think that's extremely, extremely important. The problem is if you live in an area where you only get to respond to an incident after it's already occurred, and after the police department, the trial board, that's the internal board that makes decisions about police discipline and other sort of things within police departments. If the community oversight committee isn't responding until after that's happened, then you really don't have a whole bunch of power. Instead, it needs to be oftentimes something that comes through the local government for these community and civilian oversight committees to have the power to help make decisions and inform the process about what happens, including from the information that they have. Because I found that oftentimes in the moment, it's very little at times that other people can do when they're standing around watching what's going on. But it's a lot they can do with the information they gather after the fact. And we need these civilian oversight committees to actually be able to play a stronger role besides just saying, oh, we got the data from the police department, we reviewed it, and this is what we think. Yeah, see, that's a lack of accountability because they're not changing anything. The police aren't worried about that. The public might pay attention to it, but then it's not changing the source of the problem.
Other thoughts on that question? The audience, sir, with the black shirt and the red.
Yes. Hello, my name is Sharice Sheffield. I'm the representative from Free to Fight Another DMV. One of the questions I would like to ask the panel, why hasn't the police across the country have a natural database to document their incidents, just like doctors and nurses. I know that will also cut down on the fact that if they have a license, just like doctors and nurses, when you have an infraction, you lose that license, you lose your gun, and you lose the opportunity to make money if you do bad policing. Why is it that you have a database at your station to be able to call in and say, give me the teletype on this vehicle. Give me the teletype on this individual. And this is a national teletyping situation across the country, but you don't have a national database for police officers who are bad police officers. You know, yep. Tamir Rice, prime example. No one drives up on an individual, a kid, in an open carry state, and shoots someone within 3 or 4 feet away who allegedly is supposed to have a gun. No police in their right mind does that. You know, so how is that police still able to have his job and make the city of Cleveland pay money for bad policing? So what about this database? What y'all think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good example to provide, because what people don't realize, that the officer involved in the Tamir Rice situation had a track record. And then even after the civil suit was done, because he resigned, you remember I mentioned that to you all earlier, he resigned, he then went to work somewhere else. And it wasn't until people realized that then they put public pressure and he ended up resigning again. So he's just waiting for things to die down. And the way I think about what you're saying, we definitely need national data from the federal level. So, I mean, we know how many, and Dr. David Johnson, who works with me in the Lab for Applied Social Science Research, we talk about this, and he has something to say. Like, we know how many people get the flu every year. We know how many people get killed by jellyfish. But we don't know how many people get killed by the police. I don't know about you, but as a taxpayer, that's just really disturbing. And so part of it isn't just the lack of accountability for police department. It's also at the federal level. Why is this needed? Because, again, it goes back to the fact that police departments and police officers are not trained to do this. The police departments I've worked with, and I know Captain Perez has seen this. Dr. Levine, I know you've seen this. I've walked into police departments where they're like, yeah, I mean, if you want to help us think about our data, we walk into a room this size and there are boxes filled up with white paper in it. And they're like, yeah, I mean, if you want to help us, go ahead. Because we are asking police officers to do something that they're not trained to do. And there have been some politicians, including some Democratic presidential candidates, who have suggested that we should do this and actually presented some legislation on it. And that really needs to be doubled down. These are things that the public, as taxpayers, can actually demand and ask for. And there's no reason why in 2019, as we're talking about technology that can fly over people and track their face, that we don't know when a police officer shoots someone. It's a travesty.
It is challenging, though, because there's something like 18,000 independent law enforcement agencies in this country, and they don't have to do anything that the federal government tells them to do. So you need a different kind of federal leadership that actually incentivizes them to start collecting and reporting that data.
Yep.
We'll give you money for your shiny toys if you comply with our requirements for collecting and sharing this data.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. And I think it's a great idea and it's important. You know, the state of Maryland implemented, well, we have a training commission, and most states have them, that you get certified through them to be a police officer. And now Maryland is requiring us to send them use of force data. You know, and the thing about it is, you know, we have to make things mandatory, and then we have to follow up and make sure that people are complying. Because, I don't know, last year, there was an article in the Post about a couple of agencies that didn't provide that data for over a year.
Yeah,
I mean, we were one of them. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, implementing these rules, making them mandatory is great, but now you got to follow up and make sure that people are held accountable for actually doing what they're supposed to do.
I do want to just give a shout out to the media and to journalists. They've done so much to shine a bright light on what's happening in this country and doing a Freedom of Information Act requests and otherwise trying to get the data out there. It's not the solution, but it's really nice to know that they're out there doing that work.
This gentleman up front here.
I don't think I need a mic. Hi, my name is Joshua. So with the increased use or the emergence of facial recognition cameras, and that we all can acknowledge that the demographics in this country are changing, how would that affect policing in the future?
I think when it comes to facial recognition and artificial intelligence and these sort of things, part of the fundamental problem is that the databases aren't anywhere near complete. And they misclassify minorities. So
can
to your point,
one thing, I'm sorry. It can only accurately detect the features of white males. So it cannot detect the features of white women or other minority groups.
Well, part of the reason why it lacks the ability to detect is because the algorithms build on themselves and it's not enough people in the database to properly detect people. So part of what people don't realize about technology and artificial intelligence is that as the machine learning program goes, then the more people that are in, that are being calculated, so if we bring in technology in here that scans everyone's faces, now we are put into the database. But before that happens, we're not in the database. So the less people they have that they are testing on, the less sites that they use. So, for example, if they're out in Silicon Valley, the United States doesn't look like Silicon Valley. It looks like what you just said. So that leads to gaps in the technology. And the problem with that, this is what's key, is that it leads to misclassification in who might do something. Mm-hmm. So if they're looking for me and they have somebody who they think looks like me, they might get you because they think we look that much alike. And so I think when it comes to technology, the problem is that in order for it to get better, we actually have to, the technology actually has to have the ability to have more people to include in the database. And that's problematic for a lot of people because people consider these sort of things privacy violations. But when we walk in airports, particularly like D.C., a lot of people walk in DCA and they're like, wow, it's so open. For law enforcement officials, that's a good thing because they're using that facial technology. They're using the thermal type of technology they have that can scan people's bodies and actually see what's going on. They do this at the metro stations as well. So everyone is being calculated when they're going in these spaces and people don't realize it. I think one way to solve it, and Daryl West, who is head of governance studies here, he just put out a piece on technology. And one thing he said is when you walk into a space, not only does it need to say that it's being recorded, but it also needs to say that that facial recognition technology is being used. And there should be ways where people can opt in and out of that process.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Ma'am, with the black jacket.
Good morning. My name is Beverly John, and I am a member of a community justice coalition in Prince George's County. I was wondering if the panel could speak to the issue of there's the law enforcement officers' bills of rights that I know is in Maryland. I'm sure they're in other jurisdictions as well. Can you talk about the impact of maybe repealing that type of documents and the impact that it has on actually preventing transparency and accountability in our police departments? And is it possible that we could get a repeal of those types of documents?
We all look to you.
You want to start?
And then
I guess I could touch on it. I think that, let me start by saying this. As an organization, for the last probably 4 years, we've shown up to Annapolis, all right, to testify in favor of bills that would strengthen those law enforcement officer bill of rights, you know, for the community.
Can you talk a little about what's in one of those?
Well, the gist of it is it gives the officer a right, and they changed it. About 2 years ago or so, they changed it. We used to have 10 days. So if I was involved in a shooting, a police-involved shooting, I had 10 days before I had to give a statement, all right? So you would have no clue of what happened for those 10 days unless there was a video somewhere or some other eyewitnesses. But if it was me and that person and he's dead, you know, you don't know exactly what happened. You know, so they changed it to now we have five days. You know, and then another change, which was good, I mean, it needs to be strengthened a little bit, is you could have one or two civilians on our police trial boards, you know. So when an officer gets charged with a particular violation and he takes it to a trial board, at least now, and it's at the chief's discretion. See, that's the problem.
Yep.
You know, the only city that I know of in Maryland is Baltimore. They actually have civilians on those trial boards, which is great. Because, again, you know, like, if I do something wrong and I'm being judged, let's say I use force and I'm being judged by what I call those heavy-handed police officers, all right, that's who's judging me, what do you think they're going to say, you know? They're going to clear me. Oh, I wasn't that bad. You know, we did worse back in the day and all that good stuff. But if you have some civilians in the room, right, that they're going in with a different perspective, you know, that might help us be more accountable.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think Captain Perez probably said something to shock people that I think was really, really important. That if there is a use of force incident, that officers have a series of days before they give a statement. I want you all to think about that. That's highly problematic. Well, what happens during that time is they consult with the Fraternal Order of Police, and they come up with a statement and a byline that they want to give the public. So in the incident, like in Prince George's County with Donald Johnson, who was just body slammed that paralyzed him from the neck down recently, this is one of these incidents where there was something that was put out and stated that is actually different from what actually happened as more video footage is coming out. And I think what happens is we have to question ourselves as a society, where if our law enforcement officials who are paid by taxpayer money are given days before they give a report and a statement about something that happened to someone who they're supposed to be protecting and serving. And this is why, in many regards, these Bill of Rights is problematic. Now, at the same time, to Joe's point, what is key, and the reason why Baltimore has civilians on their trial board, is because of the consent decree. Mm-hmm. So hopefully you're starting to see a pattern, right? So Baltimore, which, I mean, if you live in this area, you've just been paying attention. I mean, it's had a lot of issues over the past several years. But part of the consent decree that's been handed down is to put civilians on that trial board. That trial board is really, really key, because the trial board is the internal, essentially, jury that makes the decision on the reprimands and discipline of officers. And having civilians on that for transparency is extremely, extremely important.
You reminded me of something around a controversy around body-worn cameras, which is that as jurisdictions have begun implementing them, there's been a question about whether officers have a right to view that footage after an incident occurs.
Before they actually give their statement.
And which is just very interesting. Like, okay, because the person you just killed doesn't have that opportunity.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, one compromise would be have them give a statement immediately. And if they want to then view the footage and modify that statement, go right ahead. But at least you get both versions.
Great point.
And I'll tell you this, I'm a police officer. I've been a police officer for 25 years now. And when I first went to internal affairs, I was a little in shock because I went in as an investigator, low-level investigator. Even though you're a sergeant, you had to be at least a sergeant to investigate other officers. And, you know, my first couple cases, the person who's training me says, all right, before you interview him, make sure that you show him all the video, all the evidence, the complaint, and all of that. Mm. And I was like,
why?
Huh? And then the reason for it was that, you know, you want him to refresh his memory as to what happened that particular day, you know. And then down the line, we've had commanders. And again, this is where what I say about setting the tone. Then we had commanders sending emails saying from, you know, moving forward, you know, because there were times that we didn't do that. And there was reason for that. They'd send an email down. You know, the boss is sending an email down saying, from now on, every officer that comes in here, if we have evidence, we show it to them first. I mean, so they're setting the tone of what we're doing, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's times that you probably shouldn't show that person a video, you know. And I could give a quick example. We had a guy who was chasing a guy who he thought was robbing a store, was going to rob a store. He chased them behind a building. This is about 10 years ago. And back there, the officer discharged his weapon. The officer said that the guy, reached for his weapon, tried to take his weapon, and the gun went off and all this stuff, this whole story, right? And there was other officers also running behind the officer who discharged his weapon. Well, the short story is basically we charged this guy with attempt murder on a police officer, all these charges, and then one of our IA investigators found the video from a commercial building. Mm-hmm. And what actually happened was the officer's chasing right behind them. He's right behind them, and the guy decided to stop and give up, basically. He stopped. All he did was turn around. He didn't even raise his hand. Next thing you know, you see it on video, the officer hitting the guy on the side of the face with the gun, and it goes off. All right. And not only did we drop the charges and all that, and you know, he got charged criminally, but guess what? He retired, you know. But you know that's an example there.
We're out of time.
Yeah, I think we are just out of time. Unfortunately, I'm sorry we did not get to all the questions today. But let's give a round of applause for our superb panelists.